This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. You're listening to Wake Up Call.
Hold on.
Tuesday, July 27th. Welcome, I'm Esther Amar, Ife Dancy on engineering duties. 71 degrees at the moment, your high today, 88 degrees. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, the price of citizen journalism with a Shirley Sherrod case, the politics of race within this White House, and how BP used incarcerated folk in the cleanup of the Gulf of Mexico oil catastrophe while residents struggled. The lens of the media, dissected and discussed via stories from the New York Times, ABC, NBC, Common Dreams, MSNBC, in our all-women media panel with regulars April Silver and Stacey Patton, joined by guest panelist, activist and community organizer Monifa Bendele. New York City Comptroller John Liu joins us to talk audits of subway elevators and escalators for the disabled 20 years after the passage of the American Disabilities Act. And charge them. We talk with an attorney from a watchdog organization whose letter to Maryland's Attorney General and State's Attorney demands criminal charges be filed against James O'Keefe, Hannah Giles, and Andrew Breitbart for videotaping Acorn employees in that state without their knowledge or consent. Coming up this first hour.
We need to stop this violence.
We need
these kids to know what they're going to do when they get bigger. Either they're going to be a scientist or do whatever they got to do, long as it's good. We need to have a good future out here. We need education. That's why we're trying to save our schools and stop the violence. If we got violence, how are we going to save our schools?
A young Newark resident makes a plea to stop the violence in Newark, New Jersey, where so many people have been killed already this year at the hands of other residents and the police. As Newark marks its one-year anniversary last week of weekly acts of civil disobedience, Wake Up Call's news editor Gail Walker reports on the work of the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition and joins the residents is on the rallies and in the streets as she hears from Newark community in their fight to save a city and its residents plagued by violence. Stimulus money, how and who is it helping? Community leaders lead a bus tour from New York City to Poughkeepsie tomorrow to find out. How can we recognize the mental health issues that impact teen suicide? A New York psychologist explains as ASTA services for children and families faced a higher number of serious suicide attempts by youth in 2009 than in its entire history. Just saying no to Nike. Honduras is the scene of a victorious battle against the shoe giant by United Students Against Sweatshops. We hear from them. Hydrofracking. It's the drilling method which uses toxic chemicals under high pressure in water to break up rock formations deep underground to release natural gas. Activists argue it's dangerous. Well, the issue hits the table in the New York State Legislature tomorrow. All of that and more coming up. But we start with local, national and global news headlines. We say good morning to Wake Up Call's news editor, Gail Walker. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, Esther. Here's some of what's in the news. The European Union has adopted a new package of sanctions against Iran, targeting the Islamic Republic's foreign trade, banking, and energy sectors. These sanctions, which were agreed to in principle by EU leaders in June, are the latest in a series of measures taken by the international community in an effort to disrupt Tehran's nuclear program. Iran, meanwhile, has sent a letter to the International Atomic Energy Agency stating that it is ready to resume negotiations about a nuclear fuel swap without any preconditions, according to the country's state media. The new EU measures, formally adopted on Monday at a meeting of the bloc's Foreign Affairs Council, will come into force in the next few weeks after they are published in the EU's official gazette. They will include a ban on the sale of equipment, technology, and services to Iran's energy sector and come a month after the U.S. passed similar sanctions. Iranian officials denounced the EU decision as unnecessarily confrontational. The latest EU and U.S. restrictions come on top of a fourth round of sanctions imposed last month by the UN Security Council. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Desmond Tutu has announced he is retiring from public life after this year when he turned 79, saying the time has now come to slow down and spend more time with his family. the former Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, said after his birthday on October 7th that he will limit his time in the office to one day per week until February 2011. It is Tutu who labeled South Africa the Rainbow Nation of God to celebrate its diverse cultures. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 and then used his new international stature to step up the campaign against apartheid. Tutu led calls for punitive sanctions against South Africa, remaining one of the few strong voices inside the country while other activists were imprisoned or forced to operate abroad. He was ever present during the turbulent final years of apartheid and the ensuing transition to majority rule. He also headed the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. For more than 2 years, the panel listened to people testifying about torture, killings, and other atrocities during the apartheid era. Former South African President Nelson Mandela made a similar decision to largely retire from public life back in 2004. Tutu said once he steps down, he will stay involved with the Nobel Laureate Group and a group of international statesmen and women brought together by Mandela, known as the Elders. Tutu also will remain involved in the Desmond Tutu Peace Center in Cape Town. BP's chief executive is said to be negotiating the terms of his departure as the oil firm attempts to repair its image after the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Officials of the energy giant met Monday to discuss whether Tony Hayward should resign in a possible multi-million dollar payoff, UK media reports. Britain's Sky News Television, citing sources, said Hayward was likely to be proposed for a non-executive role on the board of TNK-BP, a joint venture in Russia. Meanwhile, the BBC said Hayward could leave with a total payoff and pension package worth around $18.5 million would he step down in October. While BP said on Monday that no final decision had been made about Hayward, it appears that BP's managing director, Bob Dudley, would likely take over as CEO. Hayward has been criticized for a string of public relations goofs during the crisis, including telling reporters, "I want my life back." Monday's meeting comes a day after the release of second quarter results, which are expected to reveal a $30 billion provision for funding the oil disaster. BP capped the leaking well last week, choking off the flow of oil for the first time since the April 20th explosion killed 11 workers on a drilling rig and sent crude gushing into the Gulf. About 300 indigenous people from 8 ethnic groups have released about 100 workers who have been held hostage on the banks of the Arapuena River in protest to protest the construction of a hydroelectric dam over what they consider a holy site, Brazilian state media reports. Government officials were to meet yesterday with representatives from the dam and the National Foundation for Indigenous Affairs in the state of Mato Grosso, the state-run news agency reports. The indigenous people, who painted their bodies as a declaration of war, encircled a large area where the Darro Daniels hydroelectric dam is under construction in Mato Grosso. The Brazilian Indians are asking for reparations for what they claim has been an attack on their sacred land, said Antonio Carlos Ferreiro Alcanio, the local coordinator for the National Foundation for Indigenous Affairs. "They don't want money in their hands," Alcanio said. "What they want is a sustainable program in the area that will recover the loss that they have suffered in this archaeological site." Aquino says the Indians who took over the land early Sunday afternoon had not provoked any violence. According to estimates from the foundation, there are 33 distinct ethnic tribes and about 25,000 Indians in the state. The dam is expected to supply electricity to 600,000 people daily. And finally, in a split decision, the New Jersey Supreme Court has declined to hear a case from six same-sex couples seeking the right to marry, saying the case first needs to wind its way through the lower courts. "This matter cannot be decided without the development of an appropriate trial-like record," wrote the Chief Justice. "We reach no conclusion on the merits of the plaintiff's allegations regarding the constitutionality of the Civil Union Act." The couples filed the case in the aftermath of the failure of same-sex legislation in the state Senate, arguing that the state's 2006 civil union law had failed to grant them the full rights and benefits of heterosexual married couples that the court mandated the legislature provide them with 4 years ago. They will now have to file a new complaint in Superior Court, which will then have to climb the rungs to reach the state Supreme Court. And that's just some of the news this morning. I'm Gail Walker.
Thank you, Gail. Here's some Benjamin with sports.
No for A-Rod, but no in Tampa. The baseball world was looking for history on Monday night, and history was made, but it wasn't from the one everyone expected it from. New York Yankees third baseman Albert Rodriguez entered the evening sitting on 599 career home runs, one away from 600, which will put him on a list with just six others in the history of the game. The Yankees were in Cleveland for the start of a seven-game road trip, and Rodriguez went hitless on the evening in four plate appearances. The Yankees trailed 2-1 going into the eighth inning, and that's when they got a two-run blast from center fielder Curtis Granderson, which gave the Yankees a 3-2 lead. The home run for Granderson was his third in two games. Closer Mariano Rivera came into the game in the ninth inning to pick up his 21st save of the season. Now, the teams chasing the Yankees for first place in the American League East Division are the Tampa Bay Rays. And down in Tampa Bay, Florida last night, pitcher Matt Garza threw the first no-hitter in Tampa Bay Rays history in a 5-0 win against the Detroit Tigers. Garza threw the no-hitter on 120 pitches and was a walk away from throwing a perfect game. Tampa Bay currently trailed the Yankees by 3 games for first place. The no-hitter was the 5th this season, and the most ever in a season is 7, and that happened in 1991. The New York Mets were idle last night and began a 6-game homestand this evening. Tonight's opponent are the St. Louis Cardinals, and the Mets entered the day trying to hang on after just completing an 11-game West Coast road trip to begin the post-All-Star break, in which they lost 9 of 11 games. Currently, the Mets trail first-place Atlanta by 7.5 games, and they are 5.5 games removed from the San Francisco Giants for the wild card lead. And finally, former Ohio State University running back Maurice Claret, who starred for Ohio State as a freshman and helped lead them to a national championship in 2001 before going to jail for 3.5 years for armed robbery in 2006, was released from jail in April and is now back at Ohio State after enrolling in classes as he attempts to earn his degree. This is Samori Benjamin, WBAI Sports.
12 minutes past 6, you're listening to Wake Up Call. 100 people have been killed in the city of Newark, New Jersey already this year. Residents have struggled with murder at the hands of fellow residents and the police. Concerned citizens, activists and elected officials describe the city as being plagued with violence. Within the last 2 weeks, at least 3 people were killed in the city's South Ward, and a Georgia businessman visiting the city was gunned down by a Newark police officer in Branch Brook Park. Community residents have taken to the streets to highlight the problem and to urge city leaders to take action. The Newark Anti-Violence Coalition is a group of community residents who have been holding weekly demonstrations to draw attention to the violence. Last Wednesday marked the 1-year anniversary of the weekly acts of civil disobedience. Wake Up Call's news editor Gail Walker filed this report on the work of the coalition.
Deadly violence has claimed nearly 100 lives in Newark so far this year.
On this corner right here, a lot of brothers have already died. And that corner too. It's been years.
We work hard like everybody else. Our kids need to live. No, they need to play in the streets every day without getting shot.
You know me, you knew my son through me. Son is a good kid.
Newark, New Jersey residents say violence is gripping the city, creating a public health crisis. In 2010, there have been 46 murders across the city. Citing that figure, Mayor Cory Booker and Police Director Gary McCarthy say things are getting better. More than a decade ago, violence was at its height. Time magazine ranked Newark the most dangerous city in the nation. But many residents argue that those numbers alone don't tell the full story. Coalition organizer and National Minister of Culture for the new Black Panther Party, Zaid Muhammad, says behind those numbers are real lives, families, and communities ripped apart by the violence.
You know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Somewhat they done some crunching on some numbers and some have gone down. But the fact is this behavior is still a dominant trend in the city. It's still something that drives and is undermines in a very obvious way the social fabric of a large percentage of people in this city. Across the ages, across the wards, a lot of people are living in fear in spite of whatever their policy direction is and whatever McCarthy does.
On July 20th, 2009, Nakisha Allen was on her way to the store when she was shot to death on the sidewalk outside her apartment building. The 36-year-old mother was yet another innocent bystander killed in a drive-by shooting in the city. Following her death, residents, fed up with the shootings, gathered to form the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition. Since then, every week the group has shut down intersections across the city to draw attention to the violence and to call on city leaders to address it. Organizer Bashir Akinyele explains.
You know, there's a grassroots effort. I mean, literally, people from the neighborhood said, no more. We're going to use civil disobedience. We're going to shut down traffic. And we're not just going to do it in the hood. We're going to do it in mainstream Newark, downtown Newark. We're going to shut down traffic 280.
The weekly actions are both cathartic and a call to action. The rallies offer an opportunity for the community to express its support for the families that are being destroyed by the violence. Coalition member, Sister Ciesia.
Since July last year, we've been doing this since July. Since the 36-year-old Sister Nakisha was shot over on Meeker and Elizabeth Avenue. She was the inspiration. She left two or three babies behind. 36 years old, and your son, I put bond on it, did not die in vain.
Muhammad says the weekly gatherings let surviving family members know that their loved ones are not forgotten.
We're losing kids, and there's no loss like that. And when a family is confronted with a tragedy like that and gets embraced by a community the way they should, they say that it has made a difference with them being able to bear something that is unbearable in ways that we can't describe with the English language. And that's been the most moving thing about what we've done.
The organizers have taken the vigils to all parts of the city. Even Mayor Cory Booker's residence has been the scene of protest. Why the mayor? Ross Baraka is the newly elected city council member for Newark's South Ward and a key force behind the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition. He says as the chief executive officer of the city, Mayor Booker has a responsibility to address the calls of the coalition.
A couple of them that he can do something about directly and immediately. One is the removal of the police director. One being calling the mass meeting of all of the organizations in the city, street organizations as well as nonprofits, legal organizations in terms of court organizations and juvenile justice system and health organizations to clear the shootings in Newark, a public health issue, and begin to address the resources in terms of crime in that direction. He could deal with those things immediately, and he hasn't done it. It's coming to his residence to get him to answer to that, I think, is very direct in terms of what it is we want him to do.
Organizers also say a major problem is the police. Brutality at the hands of the police, as well as the need for community-minding policing. Many Newark residents see Police Director Gary McCarthy, the former Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the New York Police Department, as a volatile and divisive figure. Under McCarthy's watch, residents say they've seen a rise in police violence and the resources of the department directed to the downtown core and away from their communities. From its inception, the coalition has called for his resignation. In fact, in April, the coalition took their demands to his doorstep, holding a demonstration in front of his home. But the coalition says it's about more than getting rid of one person. They call for a comprehensive approach that gets at the root of the problem. Chief among them, jobs for community residents. While the nation conservatively struggles with a 10% to 11% unemployment rate, in Newark, the rate hovers around 15% in general and is as high as 50% for young black men. Some claim the figure is even higher. Meanwhile, Mayor Booker has furloughed city workers in an effort to bridge the city's $100 million budget gap. The mayor has already laid off 70 city workers and is also set to lay off hundreds more. Despite the city's fiscal woes, Vaughn says one of the things keeping young men and women chained to the streets is the lack of employment opportunities. He says that's why one of the coalition's demands is for the city to provide jobs. Ross Baraka echoed the sentiment and says he'll make jobs and development a priority for Newark residents.
The whole idea of addressing crime as a public health issue
and bringing resources to these communities other than just police and cameras, resources that help parents take care of their children, raise their children, giving them the resources they need to do that, bringing jobs and recreation to these communities, cultural and community development to these neighborhoods that are starving for attention and economic and social development. Those are the kind of things that we're going to try to push the administration to do in this city, particularly in the South Ward where I'm elected, and hopefully all around the city where working people live.
Organizers say a key part of addressing violence is working closely with younger generations who society has pushed to the margins and criminalized. Akinyele says the answer lies in addressing the myriad of issues that contribute to the problem of violence.
But why don't we deal with the problem? The problem that's creating the poor conditions in the schools, in the neighborhoods, in the communities, you know, that these young people come from. So this thing is so deep, man. So when you pull back the pages of violence, you know, you deal with all of those issues, poverty, self-hatred, miseducation, police brutality, COINTELPRO, drugs, all of that has created this rampant violence in America, but particularly in black and brown communities.
Muhammad says part of the work also entails sensitizing the community to the surge of violence.
This is also a real sensitizing campaign for our community as well. We do not want to see our community, especially the generation behind us, become so accepting of this thing to the point where in their minds it becomes something normal. And that's something that we've been seeing and what we've been hearing from kids in that 14 to 21 age range. Our kids will plan for their funerals, but they're not planning for their futures.
Organizers have called for violence to be declared a public health epidemic. This week marks the one-year anniversary of Nakisha Allen's death. Muhammad says it's now time for the coalition to incorporate other tactics.
We're very much at a crossroads. There's some decisions that have to be made as to how to continue to proceed. My modest judgment, we should be really looking at moving towards, you know, a lobbying component. On the one hand, that really tries to turn each city official around, each elected city official around, one by one, ward by ward, and as mayor. On the other hand, there's a need also to do some more programmatic things that we can do for ourselves to bring community people together, and that can actually have us working with some young people in a hands-on way to make a difference in those lives that we can touch that are still here, as opposed to responding after lives have been taken.
Even Newark's youngest residents are clear about what's needed in their community.
It feels good to make a difference in all the good stuff that's going around. You know how Martin Luther King used to do it? Uh-huh. It's just like that.
We need to stop this violence.
Uh-huh.
We need these kids to know what they're going to do when they get bigger. Either they're going to be a scientist or do whatever they got to do, long as it's good. We need to have a good future out here. We need education. That's why we're trying to save our schools and stop the violence. If we got violence, how are we going to save our schools?
Go ahead, baby.
We need to save our schools and our streets and this young and innocent people.
That's right, beautiful. That's right.
Come on.
Reporting for WBAI's Talkback with Hugh Hamilton, I'm Gail Walker.
The Liquid Sound Lounge, originators of the Soulful Dance Boat Party, invites you to another high sea adventure on Friday, July 30th, 2010. The lineup will include Genie Hopper on the decks, along with guest DJ Cosmo, and live saxophone and flutes by Jay Rodriguez. And it's all happening at the Half Moon at the East River Marina on 23rd Street under the FDR. Boarding time is at 11:30 p.m. We'll leave from the docks at 12:30 a.m. and we will return back to the docks at 3:30 a.m. For more information, go to liquidsoundlounge.com, and some of the proceeds will go to artforprogress.org. Make sure you reserve your spot on the dance floor. And don't miss the boat.
check this out. This is Chuck D and Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
James there, I Want It All, from her album My Soul. 26 minutes past 6. Now, how is stimulus money impacting investments in communities? Members of Community Voices Heard will show their neighbours and elected officials exactly how when they lead a bus tour from New York to Poughkeepsie tomorrow. The membership-led and directed organisation is made up of 25,000 low-income individuals in New York City, Yonkers, Newburgh and Poughkeepsie. The tour will focus on four programmes that received investments under the Recovery Act, including public housing capital funds, temporary assistance for needy families, job creation programs, and community development block grant funds. Anne Washington is leader of the public housing campaign and a member and board member of Community Voices Heard, and she joins us now. Anne, good morning to you.
Hi, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. So just talk to us about the tour, the stop that it's going to make, and who you expect to meet at each location.
Yes. Well, the tour basically what we're trying to do is to get the people in the neighborhoods of, like you just mentioned, just of the New York City, Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, and Yonkers. Basically, we're trying to get them to the people of the neighborhoods where the stimulus recovery has supposed to have been impacted, to let them see what has been happening. We want to let public officials actually see what is going on, because we feel that a lot of people have been talking about the Recovery Act, especially if you look on TV, you hear them talking about the Recovery Act, and they don't think it has been making really much of an impact on, if you listen to things, they said, oh, it has failed, it has not made any difference. But basically, we're trying to show them where it has made a difference, and actually to show them where, because of the fact that we feel that we really should have had more, because people who are in public housing, we have needed much repairs, and the people who are getting, TANF, that's the temporary assistance program. We also do need jobs. We, of course, with the CBDG, which is the community block grant funds, also, we're just trying to show them just how it has impacted our neighborhood. I'm not sure exactly when people talk about the fact that it's failed, what they're really looking for, but we want to show them the fact that it really has made a difference in some of our neighborhoods, even though we feel that, it really shouldn't, it really could have been more, actually.
And you said one of the things you want to do is show that actually there are specific ways in which stimulus funds did benefit low-income people. Describe some of the ways that you're talking about.
Okay, definitely. Like right now, public housing did get a specific amount of money from the stimulus funds to take care of actually it's for capital funds, you know, to take care of like the infrastructure, take care of a lot of problems that we have, because public housing has really been there's been a lot of disinvestment in public housing for many years. You know, for years the city and state in right here in New York City, actually in New York period, have not funded public housing. And because of the lack of funding and the lower, the small amount, even though we have been receiving funding from the federal government, we have been receiving less funds. It's almost like they feel, well, what is the point of taking care of, public housing, because it doesn't really make a difference. It's going to, because the people don't care. At least that's how they feel. Maybe let's just get rid of it. So because of the fact they have not been taking care of public housing, a lot of the infrastructure has been, you know, falling apart. Now, the Recovery Act really did actually give money to take care of the capital funds, meaning, like I just said, to take care of infrastructure, and it really has made a big difference. So we are basically trying to take to people around in the tour so they can see just how it has made an impact in public housing. Even though, like I just said, we feel it hasn't really given it hasn't been enough. And also with the temporary assistance, I know for a fact that many people who were getting public assistance, families were able to get like a little extra money on their checks. I mean, and even also like the food stamps has increased. Also, the Recovery Act is supposed to create more jobs within low-income neighborhoods, not just public housing, the neighborhoods surrounding public housing, any sort of, because of the Recovery Act, like I just said, if you're trying to create, to fix up the infrastructure, they're supposed to hire people who are in the neighborhood or in there to have them work there. So it has created some jobs, even though, like we say, we don't feel it has been enough.
And so if listeners would like to know more about the tour tomorrow, if they would like to be able to participate, can you give them a number that they can maybe call for some more information?
Yes. Our Community Voices Heard. Our number is 212-860-6001. And
Just do that one more time, and a little more slowly.
Okay. The number for Community Voices Heard, maybe I should give you the address too, so people would just have a note. It's 115 East 106th Street on the third floor, and that's in New York, New York 10029, and the number is 212-860-6001.
Do you have a website as well, Anne?
Yes.
Okay, let's take that as two.
It is www.cvhaction.com. That's ACTION.org.
Just one more time.
www.cvhaction.org.
Anne Washington, a member and board member of Community Voices Heard and leader of the Public Housing Campaign. Thank you so much for joining us, Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. ASTA services for children and families in 2009 faced a higher number of serious suicide attempts by youth that they serve than the agency had ever seen in its history. Now, none of these attempts were successful. But in what way does the increase in teens attempting suicide receiving services from this agency reflect what is happening across the nation? What are the signals that a teen is in danger, and what more can we do? Psychologist and team leader from ASTA's Bronx Community-Based Behavioral Health and Prevention Services, Dr. Paul Bullman, joins us now to explain. Dr. Bullman, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Very sobering information. Talk to us about what we all need to understand about teen attempts at suicide, and what perhaps parents and caregivers need to know as well.
Absolutely. One of the mistaken assumptions that people have about teen suicide and suicide in general is that it's simply caused by stress, when in fact, more than 90% of cases of kids or adults, really, who engage in suicidal behaviors actually have underlying mental health issues that precede the suicidal behaviors. And most often, that would include things like depression. Sometimes we'll also see a combination of substance abuse issues, rule-breaking behaviors, and these are mental health issues which are treatable.
So is the issue that the actual underlying issue is going untreated and undetected, so it is so serious by the time that something is going to be done?
Exactly. And so when it comes to prevention, one of the important assumptions not to make is that kids are going to tell you when they need help, or that you will know or recognize necessarily when they are thinking about something like suicide. The research shows us that actually it's more common for kids not to be very forthcoming about those issues, and for a variety of reasons, including the fact that kids who are depressed often are talking less, are speaking less with others, are reaching out less to others. Also, kids, as opposed to adults, have less of a feelings vocabulary, and so they're less able to sort of describe their emotions. And so it's one of the important things in terms of prevention is that it's very important for parents and others who interact with kids, teachers, et cetera, to really actively work on the relationship, keep those lines of communication open, and be very vigilant for signs of these kinds of underlying mental health issues to make sure they can get kids the help that they need.
So describe the kinds of signs that they should look for, because I can imagine caregivers and parents thinking, okay, but if they're not communicating at the point at which they do need help, if they're not talking, if they are shutting down, then what is it that I need to look for, and what would point to the fact that they're in, you know, the kind of trouble where they need to be getting some specific help?
That's a great question. So let me talk about two things with relation to that. One of which is I'd like to just talk. I think it's important for people to know what the signs of depression are,
right,
which again is probably the most common underlying mental health issue with regards to suicide. And then also, separately from that, there are also signs to look for that could signal more acutely that there's a risk of a suicidal attempt happening. Now, when it comes to depression, again, with kids, it's not necessarily going to look like the stereotypical vision that many of us may have of depression, of someone crying all the time. And again, they're not likely to be able to say, I'm depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Often for kids, they may look as though they're more moody and irritable. They may make statements about feeling bored, because kids who are depressed, as people in general who are depressed, this is true for, they lose interest in some of the activities that they used to enjoy. So the kid who used to enjoy talking on the phone to friends, going out, playing ball, all those kinds of things, you may notice them losing interest in those things. They may seem less able to concentrate, to remember things, to make decisions. You may see them having trouble sleeping. Their appetite may change. They may complain more about headaches or stomach aches, things of that sort. Their tendencies in terms of schoolwork, that may fall off. And so you may see them acting differently in those situations. And so those are some of the signs to look for in terms of depression, versus waiting for kids to reach out and tell you that they're feeling depressed. I'm sorry.
Please finish.
Sure. And I was going to then say that in terms of more acute warning signs, there's an acronym, actually, that's being used. The American Association of Suicidology is trying to sort of publicize this. The acronym is IS-PATH-WARM. And this acronym stands for the signs to look for that there may be more acute risk of someone who's thinking about suicide. And the acronym stands for the first I stands for ideation, which is thoughts. Is this person thinking, expressing themselves in some way, communicating that they're thinking about suicide, be it by talking, by notes, pictures, actions? The S stands for substance abuse. And substance abuse is a major risk factor. Kids who are abusing substances are at four times the risk. The P stands for purposelessness, expressing in some way that there's no reason to live. The A stands for anxiety, agitation, and related to that, insomnia. The T stands for feeling trapped, feeling that there's no way out of problems. And related to that is the H, which is hopelessness. Again, a big risk factor, because you're going to be experiencing a huge stressor, but if you feel a sense of hope that stressor can be resolved in some way, that's a resilience, that's a protective factor. If you feel hopeless, that's a warning sign. W in WARM stands for withdrawal from relationships. The A stands for anger, rage, revenge seeking. The R stands for recklessness or risky behaviors. And the M is mood changes, dramatic mood changes. And if you have a child, a kid, a teen, a young person who is experiencing these kinds of symptoms, those are more acute warning signs that they may be thinking about engaging in suicidal behaviors.
I guess part of the challenge is a couple of things. You know, when you talk through about some of the things around ideation, some of the things were exactly the things that you said teens who are potentially thinking about committing suicide, those are exactly the things that they wouldn't do, that they might not communicate those thoughts. They're not likely to say that I'm depressed, and the manifestation in their behavior may not be so expressive for you to be able to purely tell. And then on the other hand, for people who are looking after teenagers, the parents, caregivers, the difference between what is considered teen behavior, the moodiness, the hormonal shifts, versus when it becomes much more serious. Is there a way to distinguish one from the other, and what would you be looking for?
That's a very, very good question. I mean, in terms of your first point about the ideation, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's something that you may or may not see directly expressed. You may hear a child talking more about I just want to die. Like they might come out with a statement like that when they're upset with you. It may come out in terms of seeing them being more fixated on perhaps figures in the media or celebrities who have died by suicide. It might come out, in other words, in other ways that are not as quite as direct. But then again, there are some kids who will directly communicate that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right that is not always something that you can expect to directly hear, and therefore you need to be looking out for the other signs as well. When it comes to your second question, it's true that it can sometimes be hard for people to differentiate what seems like the normal sort of moodiness of adolescence and that sense and the fact that teens are actively trying to become more independent of their parents and withdraw from them perhaps some more. So some of the things to sort of look for there, as I mentioned before, you could see some of the other signs include things like also withdrawing from their friends or their social circles. Usually for teens, it may be relatively, like, not so abnormal for them to start to withdraw some in terms of, their parents, to not communicate as much with their parents. If you see them also withdrawing from their peer social circles, that could be a sign. If you see them withdrawing from the things that they as teens have always naturally enjoyed, and you see them stopping those activities, that's something that most teens, you won't see that with most teens. That's something that's more abnormal. And when you see then a larger pattern over a number of weeks of a teen who seems more irritable than usual, who, again, is talking about feeling bored a lot or not talking much at all with the parents or their friends and withdrawing, you have a teen again who maybe is having a rougher time sleeping. You see new patterns for them in terms of less focus on their schoolwork, things of that sort. Those are the kinds of patterns that parents can look for that would be different than that of the typical teen.
I wonder if you could is there a site that folks can. You can direct folks to get more information about exactly the thing that you're talking about, signs to look for, just for all of us who need more help and better understanding.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're saying in terms of websites?
Yes.
Or things of that sort? Sure. Well, there's the, let me mention the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. They have a website that's www.sprc.org. And so that's one resource. They're actually the ones, I believe that they're the ones who have the hotline that's very important for people to know about. This is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which no matter where you are in America, you can call this number to get connected with local crisis intervention services. And through that number, if you're concerned about a teen, or you can direct it, help a teen themselves to call this number. It's 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-TALK. TALK. And speaking of talking, just to sort of put this out there also, one thing that's very important you know, for parents or teachers, et cetera, to do is to talk, is to really be talking with their kids. And, you know, one of the myths out there about suicide is that if you ask someone, are you thinking about suicide, that maybe if they weren't, that will, like, implant the thought into their head, and now maybe they will think about it. And so you could sort of do harm by asking the question. That's not true. And, in fact, it's very important for parents, for teachers, for people who are seeing these warning signs to directly ask the young person, are you thinking about this? Because it's only through that kind of direct open communication that you can help, hopefully, the person communicate and get them the help that they need.
And just that website one more time, Dr. Bullman.
Sure, absolutely. This is, again, the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. It's www.sprc.org.
And that National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Hotline, once again, the number is 800-273-TALK. Dr. Paul Bullman, psychologist and team lead at ASTA's Bronx Community-Based Behavioral Health and Prevention Services. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Saying no to Nike, the largest sportswear company in the world, has to compensate 1,800 formerly subcontracted workers at Hugger and Vision Techs, two Honduran factories it closed in January 2009. A result due partly to the activists' efforts of students and workers. The compensation Nike negotiated with the CGT union in Honduras is the total amount demanded by its farmer workers and includes $1.5 million in legally mandated severance pay, priority hiring by Nike's other Honduran suppliers, a commitment to expand its sourcing in Honduras as its overall business expands, and offer priority hiring to the 1,800 affected workers, 9 months of medical care through the country's social security system, and the provision of a paid job training program. Teresa Cheng, International Campaign Director of United Students Against Sweatshops, joins us now with more. Teresa, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. What an extraordinary victory. Explain how your organization got involved in the first place.
Yeah, so United Students Against Sweatshops is a national student organization with about 100 affiliate campuses around the United States. And we run campaigns in solidarity with garment workers that make collegiate apparel because our universities contract, you know, multi-million dollar licenses with these huge corporations like Nike, like Russell Athletic, that we grant licensing rights to make our clothing. So since 1997, our organization has been vigilant in ensuring that the working conditions of these workers that are making our college apparel and bearing the name of our universities is made in humane working conditions where workers basically have the right to organize a union without any sort of intimidation, that they're paid humane wages, that they can bargain with their unions, and that, you know, workers' rights are respected. So we have a relationship with the CGT union in Honduras because of a recent campaign we actually came out of, in which we settled with a historic victory against Russell Athletic, in which Russell actually illegally shut down one of their factories for union organizing in Honduras. And through an active campaign similar to our Nike campaign in November of last year, we actually got a historic settlement with the union out of Russell Athletic, in which they agreed to not only reopen that factory in Honduras, but to pay a settlement to workers and rehire all of the workers that they had laid off, and then basically allow all of their factories in Honduras to be open to union organizing without any threat of intimidation. And Russell Athletic is the largest private employer in the country of Honduras, so this was a pretty historic agreement. And going on, the CGT union actually had another problem at a factory in Honduras after we had established this relationship with them. And this time it was in a Nike factory, in which Nike had shut down two factories, Hugger and Vision Techs, in January of this year, and left 1,800 workers unemployed without any severance pay. And so when we demanded that Nike, you know, take responsibility for these subcontracted workers and pay them severance pay, they had actually initially denied that they made any collegiate apparel in this factory and were pretty firm in affirming that there was no way that they were going to pay severance pay, and this was actually made public on their main website.
How did Nike initially react to the charges against them?
They basically, like they've been saying for the last 10 years, they said that they did not take any responsibility for their subcontracted workers, and that it was essentially the responsibility of the factory owner to pay severance to its workers, although it knows, you know, full well after all these protests against it for the last 10 years that Nike has full responsibility and full power over, you know, what happens with the factory owner and how the factory owner ultimately pays workers at the bottom based on the price that Nike pays to its suppliers.
And explain what the Fair Labor Association is and their role in winning this particular victory.
The which organization?
The Fair Labor Association.
Right. The Fair Labor Association is basically a monitoring organization that was created by corporations during the Clinton administration to basically wash their hands clean and make it look essentially like brands were taking action. The problem with the Fair Labor Association is that it's basically controlled by the very corporations like Nike, like Russell, that it's supposed to monitor, and therefore over the years has been extremely ineffective and oftentimes an obstacle in resolving worker disputes. In this case, the Fair Labor Association actually sat back and did nothing, even after workers at Vision and Hunter and Vision Techs and Huggers had actually gone to the FLA and complained about what had happened. They had actually sat back and didn't do anything. And in this case, it actually proved to be more effective because more effective monitoring organizations like the Worker Rights Consortium, which was created by students about 10 years ago as an alternative to the FLA, was able to step in and along with students and other worker rights groups really waged this campaign and move forward with it effectively.
Well, victories seem to come too few and too far between, so it's always great when you hear that, wow, the protest, the consistent, organized, strategic activism got the job done, and for once, the people won. Teresa Cheng, International Campaign Coordinator for the United Students Against Sweatshops. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. 6:51, this is Wake Up Call. Legislation calling for a moratorium on hydrofracking comes up for vote in the New York State Legislature tomorrow. Hydrofracking is a drilling process that uses toxic chemicals under high pressure in water to break up rock formations deep underground to release natural gas. And Wake Up Call first reported concerns about it back in April. Now, there are two bills, one sponsored by State Senator Addabbo and the other by Senator Thompson. The targeted material for this natural gas drilling runs through approximately 8 states, including Pennsylvania and upstate New York, and is known as the Marcellus Shale. Now, the hydrofracking drilling methods need millions of gallons of water to produce what the U.S. Department of Energy says is one of the most toxic industrial byproducts produced by gas and oil drilling. They also add it could poison New York City's water supply. William Cook is the Governmental Relations Director at the Citizens Campaign for the Environment and joins us now. William, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So take me into more detail about why hydrofracking is so dangerous for us, and just break down in more detail the threat to the water supply in New York City.
Well, there's a few issues. One is the liquid that they inject to pressurize the gas to extract it is a very toxic fluid, and it's produced by Halliburton, and it contains known neurotoxins and mutagens and carcinogens. And those are neurotoxins and carcinogens and mutagens. Very significant problem. But part of the problem is after they're done using this liquid, a significant portion comes back up out of the well and has to be processed. It is very common for that to also be radioactive because of naturally occurring radioactive material underground. And we're talking hundreds of millions of gallons. So they inject this into the ground, very toxic material, has a significant risk of contaminating groundwater and surface water from spills. But the liquid they take back off has to be disposed of. They want to put it through publicly owned treatment facilities that don't deal with radiation. So we're very concerned about, one, the liquid going in, but two, what are they going to do with it when it comes back up out? And we've seen what these companies have done all over the nation, and they leave behind them a legacy of destruction, environmental damage, just some bad stuff.
And explain the difference between the two bills by Senator Adebo and Thompson and what they're calling for.
Senator Antoine Thompson, the head of the Environmental Conservation Committee in the New York State Senate, has a bill that would delay the permitting till May of next year. Senator Adebo has a bill that would delay the permitting until the EPA study, the Environmental Protection Agency study, that has been commissioned on this issue. That could be 2 years or a little more. So the timeline is a year difference, at least. The other connection is the Adebo bill is tied to the federal study, which a lot of people believe we need to see before New York State's permitting agency, the Department of Environmental Conservation, should move forward.
Okay, so does what is clearly the stronger bill, does that have the most support within the state legislature?
There is enough Senate votes to pass either one of these pieces of legislation currently. Last count, we had enough senators that would vote for either. But what we didn't have was leadership that would bring one to the floor of the Senate.
Right. And so talk about the New York City Council reaction. How have they responded to this?
The New York City Council has been very out in front, very outspoken, very saying, hey, we've got to do something. The state legislature, because the New York City Council does not have the authority that the state legislature does, but the New York City Council has been saying, hey, guys up in Albany, do something. So have a lot of people.
I know. I can say the whole of New York, the tri-state area, is saying to Albany, do something.
Yeah, and to date, Albany has not. And we believe that it not only puts at risk New York City's drinking water system, but also a number of drinking water supplies across the state affecting many, many millions of people.
So then, in those areas where the drillers have succeeded, can you give us an example of the impact of hydrofracking on communities?
Well, if we look just to the south to our neighbors in Pennsylvania, we have seen first to do this technology, there is a lot of surface destruction of forests, fields, construction of roads, infrastructure. But once they are drilling and producing gas, there have been a number of problems with private wells and with surface waters, and it leaves a situation where once you've contaminated a drinking water supply or a surface water supply, it's almost impossible to remediate, to clean it up, to make it back the way it was. So across the country, we're seeing people whose wells are damaged, people whose property values are damaged. We're seeing animals that are sickened or killed. We're seeing destruction of forests. We're seeing air pollution increases. We're seeing a lot of negatives associated with this technology, but what we're not seeing are the positives. The price of gas is so low that even going after this gas is a marginal venture for the industry, and we think that the risk far and away exceeds the potential value to anyone.
So then once the water is tainted, that's it? It cannot be cleaned up?
That's what science is telling us. It's not, it can't, it's almost impossible. It's, the probability is remote. And what we know, what we clearly know, is it is always cheaper to protect your water quality than to deal with it once you have degraded or destroyed it.
And what kind of sicknesses are we talking?
Well, if you look at what these chemicals can do, or if you look at what radioactive liquid can do, it's life-changing. And when these chemicals get into a water supply, the damage can be short-term quick, like when cows drank some frack fluid in one state and were dead within hours. But it also can be long-term. The damage from these chemicals can affect somebody so profoundly that it affects the next generation they produce. So the adverse impacts can be very quick, or they can be years and decades away. But that doesn't make them less real.
So then if listeners want to encourage their state's elected officials to support the stronger bill and just elevate that support, what might they do?
I our view is that Citizens Campaign for the Environment, that we would like the legislature to do something. I'm not sure people should be saying do the Addabbo bill or do the Thompson bill. I think people should be saying to the New York State Senate, do something, and to the New York State Assembly, do something. But for the legislature not to take action on this issue is to abdicate their responsibility. This is what the legislature has failed to do, is represent the people. And people should call their state assembly members, they should call their state senator, they should call the Department of Environmental Conservation and insist that our government represent us.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.